Most young women don't think about fertility as an issue until later in their years. But Dr. Daniel Reilich says that may be changing. As the fertility sector is taking on new preventive forms, women can now predict if they are at a higher infertility risk and make plans about their reproductive future. KCSB's Nkechi Ikem speaks with Dr. Daniel Reilich, who explains how fertility medicine is changing. This is part one of the interview.
April 23rd to 29th is going to be National Infertility Awareness Week, and you have a background in fertility. Can you tell us a little bit about your background, when you got started, and what you do now in that industry?
Well, first, my name is Daniel Reilich. I have two titles. First of all, I'm an obstetrician gynecologist, and also I'm a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist. And I started in medical school at University of Illinois, progressed on there for residency in OBGYN, after which did a fellowship at the University of Chicago for infertility and reproductive endocrinology. After which I went into private practice and been practicing for about 14 years. I have opened up a number of IVF centers across the United States. And currently I am with the Southern California Reproductive Center in Beverly Hills, and our main office for me, which is in Santa Barbara, and conducting fertility service and reproductive endocrinology therapies for patients, not only in this area, but also north into Santa Maria, down south into Ventura and Bakersfield.
Now you are the managing fertility specialist at the Santa Barbara office of the Southern Californian Reproductive Center.
Yes.
So
we have two offices that do have what's called a lab or a embryology lab. One is in Beverly Hills and also one is in Santa Barbara. And our Santa Barbara one is to create some outreach for those patients that wouldn't have to travel all the way down into the LA area.
Tell us, what are some of the ways you've seen your job change as this trend of women waiting longer to have kids has continued?
Well, we've really kind of come on to a new era in infertility. And one of them is the way we treat, and secondly is the way we diagnose. And these two things have actually come on almost simultaneously, which was actually a good thing. And they've broken down into the fact that when I used to practice medicine, when I first started infertility, is that it was almost a reactionary science. And I liken it to something like trauma surgery, where you find an injury and then you go to the hospital and the doctor there then has to try to save you. And we liken this to the patient and couple who has infertility. Then they, when they have the infertility, they go and seek care. And this is unlike a lot of other medicine, which tends to be preventative. You try to foresee a problem and try to treat it before it becomes a problem. Infertility was really almost like trauma. And for trauma surgery, we know, and trauma survival patients, we know the quickest time that they get from the time they have the event to getting to the hospital increases their survivability. And in infertility, that's what we did. We waited until people had a problem, and then we decided to then treat. The paradigm has shifted a lot because now we have much better diagnostic techniques that we can identify infertility before the event happens. So we've kind of changed the paradigm into more of a preventive care scenario. And that allows us to see people even before they try to get pregnant. Will there be a problem in the future? And if we can allow that preventative care in this, now we don't have to get all the way to the trauma and then try to save the patient. We can actually, either one, create a preventative care strategy and allow not the patient have to go through the trauma and events that they would normally go through in a more traditional setting.
Now, what are some of the causes of infertility?
Well, the causes are numerous, but divided very simply into the egg, the sperm, and the way they get together, which we call the fallopian tube. What I like to tell my patients is if you look at those three things, they really kind of take on the most infertility issues that are there. A lot of people say that the uterus is not in part of that algorithm. And I say, well, we do have a lot of data that suggests that there are very few cases that the uterus is really a barrier to achieving pregnancy. And we know that the uterus from other studies, works very well in order for it to achieve pregnancy, even in women's later years. But if we look at those three things that allow a couple to get pregnant, we know that really sperm counts, unless there's some intervening abnormality, should stay normal for someone's entire life. We know the fallopian tubes. We are almost all born with open fallopian tubes if we have them. In some cases, in rare cases, that they're not. But that event really shouldn't change unless there's some intervening pathology. However, egg production, we know, occurs once for a woman and never reoccurs. Therefore, infertility is certainly an inevitability for every woman. Therefore, there are two avenues that can be pathologic in patients, but one that is physiologic. Every woman will become infertile if they live long enough. So in essence, that degree creates a lot of burden on the biology of a woman to basically look at and make sure that parameter is running normally. So there's always somewhat of an element of female infertility in that, because we know that women, as they get more mature, are going to have a harder time getting pregnant.
How do you recognize the signs of infertility before it happens in young women?
So we understand that, again, women are born with all of the eggs they're ever going to have. And what most people don't understand is, even right from birth, women are losing eggs. On average, we think women have about 1 to 2 million eggs that they're born with. But by the time they reach puberty, which on average might be 12, 13, or 14 for someone, they only have 300,000 left. And so every month, regardless if you ovulate, you're on the pill, you get pregnant, or any other event, you're losing eggs. And you don't lose them one at a time. So any strategy that would determine what the egg composition would be for a woman will give us some indication of what her fertility status is. Now, we like to think we're all the same. But in essence, there are some women that are born with more eggs, some that born less, some that maybe lose more per month, and some that lose less. And right now, we do have some ability in our diagnostic testing to identify those people that have more eggs versus those that don't. Therefore, because the infertility is inevitable for everyone, looking at that in that context, we can kind of see where you're at in that curve. I like to liken it to somebody who takes their kid into the pediatrician and looks at the height and weight of the child. We never ask a parent, is their height and weight a certain poundage or a certain number in inches? We look at percentiles. How do you look like everybody else? Because we know that height and weight will change in children over time. You might say, I'm in the 25th percentile, the 50th percentile, and the 75th percentile. And we can do the same thing with the eggs, because we know that it's constantly changing. How do you look like everybody else in your age? And if there are extreme events where the egg numbers are smaller, we know that infertility still might be possible, but there's the chance for subfertility or even infertility to happen.
You mentioned egg freezing. Tell us about that process, and also tell us, you know, how young do you see women going in to get their eggs frozen?
Sure. First of all, egg freezing has recently come about, and people ask, well, why did it take so long? Because we've been freezing sperm for a very long time. And if you look at the size discrepancy between the sperm and the egg, I liken it to a large size marble is the size of an egg, you know, one of those big, maybe jawbreakers that you get. And the size of the sperm is like the size of the head of the pin. And so if you're trying to freeze something that has an enormously large water content, you can see that basically it might be hard to do that and allow that tissue to not only freeze, but then rethaw and survive. Sperm has been easy because men in their sperm counts will have millions of sperm. And most people don't realize that when we freeze sperm, we only recover about 30 or 40%. Now, 30, 40% of a large number doesn't sound all that bad, even though the rate of survival is pretty poor. But because you have so many of the sperm to compensate in numbers, the freezing techniques didn't have to be very accurate. When you looked at the egg, you had two problems. Number one, you didn't have millions of eggs to get. You had very few. And the cell sizes got rather large. And what we learned to develop is to try to come overcome freezing a water balloon. I always tell people, you know, if your kids ever had a water balloon fight, the first thing you do is you throw it in the freezer. And what you realize, if you left it in the freezer too long, it would pop. And that's the same kind of problems we used to have with eggs. And so what we've learned to do is actually be better at freezing a water balloon. And one of the techniques we do is we basically get rid of a lot of the water and don't allow that water to form ice crystals. Thus, we don't allow that water balloon to burst. And in that sense, it's allowed the egg freezing to be as easy to achieve as it would be for sperm freezing. Now, who should take advantage of these things? Well, you might say, we know that every woman above 34 is starting to become less fertile than people that are younger than that. So if you are going to delay your career in making a family, you want to do other things, you want to delay it because of life or whatever thing else, then it allows us to freeze those cells in time for use later. But the other advantage is what we've learned is that uterus, where I told you about before, doesn't contribute a lot to the infertility because, in essence, we know we can get women pregnant almost at any age. And in our overseas counterparts, we know that they've done uterine transplants and a few pregnancies in those women. So the uterus doesn't remain a huge barrier to achieving pregnancy. And thus, the real stipulation for not achieving pregnancy is the egg. And when we freeze it, we kind of freeze it in time. And it allows that egg to be used or legalized in a later time to allow our social experience to catch up with our desires to achieve a family.